All right. Welcome to Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet. My name is David Malin, and I'm just one of your instructors today. So computers have come a long way. In fact, this course itself has been offered now for the past 10 or so years. And if you sort of look from year to year at the syllabus and the problem sets, you don't really notice many differences. But if you look back to, like, and it's not even as though this was all that long ago, to 1998, 1999, I mean, numbers, gigahertz, CPU speeds, and disk space, it was an order of magnitude difference. And yet, fundamentally, things still kind of work the same, even though we now have iPhones and iPods and the like. And so one of the biggest goals of this course is not so much to teach you about the latest and greatest, but sort of a little lower level than that. So you have a ground floor up understanding of how technology, how computers, and how the internet works. So I'm actually quite excited this year, since Dan Armendariz, who you'll meet in a moment, and I have wanted to co-teach a class for quite some time, and not so much in the sense of he shows up one week while I take a break, and vice versa, but rather to do it dynamically and interactively together, so that ideally, if we do our jobs well, you get a couple of different perspectives. We toyed for a while with the idea of me being the PC person over there, him being the Mac person. That kind of breaks down when I take out my Mac from my backpack, so we also didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves there. And ironically, he has the same PC that I have for work, so it really doesn't play so well that way. So we're going to be a little more flexible than that, but we're quite excited. This is one of my favorite courses to have taught over the past several years, because you can't help but be surrounded by this stuff. Fortunately, not so much this stuff anymore, which is an old Macintosh mouse. More likely do each of you have little computers in your pockets these days, and we'll certainly touch on such technologies as those. But Dan, do you want to say a few words?
So hi, I'm Dan Armendariz. I guess just very briefly about me, I've lectured a few other courses at the Extension School. E1 co-lectured with Ray Diaz last year in the spring, Computer Science E7, Exposing Digital Photography in the summer, building dynamic websites with David Malin, just a number of things. And so hopefully this class you'll get a very well-grounded understanding of a lot of these topics that we're talking about. And not only will you be understanding computers and the internet, but now all of the lingo that is associated with it. And in fact, if you start thumbing through your syllabus, you'll start to see some words that hopefully you don't recognize yet. And we'll certainly begin talking about that very soon.
And per this notion of getting different perspectives, Dan, for instance, has an iPhone. I have a BlackBerry, so that's at least some fodder for material there. And I'm sure we can come up with some other differences as well. So the syllabus and the description of this course in the catalog. So probably everyone in this room uses email every day, uses a computer every day, which is actually kind of different from when this course first began in 1997, 1998, where we had noobs, so to speak, back then, people who had never touched a computer. And so the course has sort of evolved over time to not so much cater to just people who have never touched a computer before, but rather folks who are more likely like yourselves who use computers every day. And you can get around, you can type your Word documents, you can check your email and such, but if something goes wrong, you end up more likely than not either just kind of ignoring the problem or picking up the phone or just hoping someone else is going to do it, or maybe you just reboot the computer and hope it goes away. And that's certainly not an uncommon reaction. So one of the goals of this course is to not, again, dwell on how to troubleshoot this specific problem and such, but try to teach you how everything on your desk or everything in your pocket actually works, so that when something does go wrong, for instance, you can kind of conjecture for yourself, well, what could possibly be the reasons? And one of the things we like to promise or to shoot for in this class, that by course's end, when the next time you go into a Circuit City or Best Buy or even Apple Store, you know, there might come a time very soon where maybe for the first time you realize, wow, I actually knew more than that computer salesman who previously might have talked completely over my head. And hopefully you'll also get a sense of when people are BSing you or who are simply stating things that are technically inaccurate. But hopefully along the way, you will have a bit of fun. And it's kind of a funny thing to say that technology is becoming fun. I mean, I remember growing up, and it was the kids who knew about computers that were kind of the geeks. This is kind of changing now, where it's sort of cool to send text messages and use email and sort of know everything about your computer. And I think it's sort of appropriate, perhaps, that Microsoft has very recently tried to overhaul its image and move away from being the sort of 1990s and 21st century equivalent of IBM, Big Blue, from yesteryear, and try to compete head-on with, say, Apple's much more playful approach to advertising. How many of you saw the first Seinfeld meets Microsoft ad involving the shoe store? Okay, kind of bad, I thought, at least. Not so funny, and I love the Seinfeld shows. This one, if you haven't seen it, is their follow-up, which is actually much better. And so what we thought we'd do for the sake of a little multimedia is play this 3 or 4 minute video that, oddly enough, really has very little to do with actual technology and more about just sprucing up Microsoft's image. But if nothing else, it's a bit surreal watching Jerry Seinfeld and Bill Gates in the same room.
There's weeds running around the tires.
Do we have any more ketchup? Bill, have you had scalloped potatoes before?
I have. Yes.
No one told me we were eating.
There's some gum in my roll.
Oh, I got some special mustard for you. There's white wine in it, like the fancy restaurants have.
I'd love a condiment with booze in it.
You're in my seat, buddy man.
She's been here for 12 years.
Did we have this yesterday?
Oh.
Why are we doing this again?
Why, Bill? Because as we discussed, you and I are the latter. You're living in some kind of moon house hovering over Seattle like the mothership. I get so many cars, I get stuck in my own traffic. We need to connect with real people.
Just by keep out of the freezer.
That's real. The fact that a design uses inheritance to buy Lumpison doesn't make it a good design. The rope option. Yes, it's okay. There's a fireball. What was that? Hey, don't touch that mustard. That's Jerry and Bill's.
You don't know.
Help! Oh.
It's my me time.
How long till it gets warm?
It never gets warm.
I've got these Greek coins that my wife doesn't know anything about. What do you think they might be worth?
Are you doing all right?
Greek.
Okay.
Red for rallies, black for slams.
What are you doing?
Chinese delivery. Whoa. Two of the most accomplished guys that respect the field turf. 30 out of 75 dudes.
I got none.
There's a weird coin.
You're in the way! How do you have just one ball?
Yes. It was right here. That leather giraffe that we got from Cobblestone Lucas.
Jordan?
I didn't take it.
It's been in our family for 6 years.
I didn't take it.
Me neither.
Well, I mean, that just leaves Gates and Seinfeld.
Are you accusing us? This is not a good feeling.
They pinched it.
Well, if you want to search our rooms, go ahead. Because I'll tell you one thing. We didn't take it.
Yeah. Let's.
Okay. I have never seen that giraffe before in my life. It's your backpack.
It's your bed.
I'm disappointed in the both of you.
You guys are so sad.
You're the real people. I can't believe you did that.
What do I want with a plastic kangaroo?
It's a leather giraffe from Cabo San Lucas.
Well, you seem to know quite a bit about it.
All there is to know.
Oh, how naive are you? Can't you see the whole thing was a setup?
Setup? But who? Why?
We know it was you.
Why?
It's her problem.
Hello, Lady Rose. I just want my room back.
Well, you got it, sister. You're not so real.
Yeah, like I told you, you've got a long head basket.
I think we connected with them.
Yeah, what?
Well, you've connected over a million people.
I know.
I can't help wondering what's next. Frog with an email? Goldfish with a website? Amiibo with a blog? If it's yes, give me a sign. Give me a little robot. Power down.
You know, I find it funny that you mentioned that this has nothing to do with Microsoft, because I would say that this also has nothing to do with the course. So.
I enjoyed that particular strip, but yes, not so much about the course. But then fine, all right. About the course, so we have had for years in the course's syllabus the following image, which again is among your one handout for tonight. It's on page 2, and it's a photograph that was taken some years ago, 1991 to be precise, of a so-called hack at MIT. So MIT every year has some number of students that do these hacks. One year, for instance, around the re-release of Star Wars, they dressed up the MIT dome to look like R2-D2. A few years before that, they connected a, I believe, working fire hydrant, working in some sense, to a water fountain. And there's a sign at top right that's cut off from the photo that says something to the effect of getting an education at MIT is like drinking from a fire hydrant. The idea being that they, and this course, in fact, if we may usurp their metaphor, you will get a lot of information thrown at you, a lot of jargon, a lot of numbers and units of measure and so forth, all stuff that you've probably seen in print or heard people talk about. And what we want to make clear up front here is that it's okay if you don't quite absorb all of that, because one of the other goals of the course, too, is really to teach you how to teach yourself or give you, perhaps equivalently, a level of comfort with the idea that if you don't know what something means, you at least know to whom to turn to or to where to turn on, say, the internet to actually look up some piece of information. And really gaining that sort of confidence when it comes to a world, technology, that up until now you might not be quite so at ease in. We thought, and I worry I'll get reprimanded again for this, it's a little more on point. We have this other video that some of you may have seen that sort of speaks to the level of comfort of other people in society when it comes to technology. And perhaps we offer this now as sort of a baseline so that if you at least can find at least one thing wrong with the video you're about to see or one thing wrong with the comments uttered during this video, perhaps you are at least off to a pretty good start. So from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Sean Wayans will be joining us. We're very excited about that. But I want to tell you about this exciting thing I've discovered. I want to tell you about the internet. I'm going out on a limb here. I'm going to stand up and be one of the first guys to say, I think this is a key. I think this thing is here to say, right now, two key internet-related issues are making rounds in Washington, D.C. One involves the Net Neutrality Act, which would allow larger, more powerful corporations higher speed access to customers, establishing a two-tier hierarchy among that. It's awfully complicated. Why don't I let an expert, say the head of the Senate Commerce Committee, which regulates e-commerce, explain?
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tools.
Something you'd hear from, let's say, a crazy old man in an airport bar at 3 a.m. Then the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, I'm sorry, I don't quite think I understand your dump truck tube symposium. Do you have something a little more practical for me?
If you don't understand those tubes, you need to build. They're filled. When you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone who puts in that tube enormous amounts of material.
There's apparently an enormous amount of material clogging Ted Stevens' tubes. Now, perhaps a little fiber optic cable might be the answer. Stevens ended his lecture by offering a concrete example of the problem. About computers or the internet. Today,
You're just the guy in charge of regulating. So
it's that last part that's the kicker, right? It is totally okay in this class if you don't currently know jack, so to speak, about computers and the internet. We're not going to publicly lampoon you in that way, but the fact that he is in fact charge of some of the laws surrounding it, a little perhaps discomforting. Why don't we segue from some of these more jovial introductions to look at some of the stuff we have coming for you this semester on the syllabus.
All right, so if you haven't yet picked up a syllabus, there is a syllabus up front along with some donuts to bribe you into staying awake, because I know how boring David can be. So if you haven't yet seen it, which you probably haven't because I just put it up, we have a website up at computerscience1.org, and you can actually find the URL in the syllabus as well, but hopefully you can read that as well. And so if you just go there, there's links to various things, one of which is the syllabus. And there you can find a variety of things, including my name, David's name, our contact information, as well as the generic email address for the entire staff, which is staff@computerscience1.org. I'll focus on that in just a little bit. But also, there are some other things that we should take a look at. So, of course, we have our classic fire hydrant, but there are some expectations that we do have in this course. It's not just all fun and games. So we do expect that you attend all lectures, and you can either do that live, as you are now, or over the internet, because we are recording these, and you should be able to find them online via our website here at computerscience1.tv. So instead of .org, it's .tv. So that's one way that you can catch up with stuff. It's also good if you want to just review a lot of the material, because even though we do our best to make sure that we speak as slowly and as clearly as possible, sometimes we get a little excited and we start talking a little bit faster and faster as we talk about things that we enjoy. And so in those cases, of course, you can feel free to raise your hand and ask us, or just rewatch the videos if you are too shy to do that. As far as grades go, we do have problem sets, two exams, and a final project. And the breakdown is as follows. The problem sets are worth 50% total. Exam 1 is worth 20%. Exam 2 is also worth 20%. The final exam is worth 10%. There is no final exam in this course. We only have the final project. Exam 1 is actually in October. The date is in the syllabus, if I can find it. All right, I'll have to come back to it later. Oh my gosh, what is going on? Exams, here we go. Okay, so the first one is Monday, October 27th. We'll cover lectures 1 through 5. The second exam will take place in lieu of lecture on December 15th, and it will cover comprehensively lectures 1 through 10. Okay, moving on from that, we do have a number of books as well. Though none are required, you may find some of them useful, and you can find all of these online. And in fact, I may a little bit later, if I remember, we'll make these available as links to Amazon.com or some similar, but you can find them available in the COOP at the Grossman Library, and also via Amazon.com or your favorite book-selling retailer. Let's see. What else do we have here? Lectures. So
let me make one note about the books.
Oh, sure.
So you'll note on the syllabus with respect to books that there are two clumps of books here. One we call Set 1 for those less comfortable, and one called Set 2 for those more comfortable. So this is the course's attempt to try to cater to sort of different types of students in the course, but because certainly among you, there's going to be some folks who not only use computers every day, but you've maybe even done some programming, you've made websites, for instance, but there's some holes in your knowledge, or you don't really, maybe you don't feel so strong on networking-related things or hardware-related things, or the opposite, whereby you may use a computer every day, but you really don't know any of that, and it would help if you would have had more access to more information. So the books, in that they sort of can be read at your own pace, at your leisure at home, we offer two different approaches. So if you are among those more comfortable, so to speak, which is a moniker you can decide for yourself, if applicable, we recommend these four books, which are slightly more technical than the other four. There is some overlap in the books in both of the sets, and in fact, the course is sort of unofficial text textbook is this top one, Computers Are Your Future. I apologize for the title. It doesn't really shout, take me off the shelf, but it is one of the best sort of overarching overviews of technology from sort of all the different aspects of the course. So you may want to turn to that for reference. But then for those less comfortable in set one, you'll see again some overlap, but also some books that dare say hold your hand a bit more without certainly talking down to you, but at least might give you some greater comfort and access to sort of additional information at home. So bear that in mind. If you have questions about either of them, do ask us which might be best. But as Dan says, they're recommended. They're not required. And do turn, as Dan says, to the interwebs for much cheaper prices than I think you'll find across the street.
That's very true. You can find a lot of the information, if not all of the information that we are going to present throughout, not only in the books, but also on the internet. And so you can find through a variety of sources. Wikipedia, of course, is one of the first ones that comes to mind, and it's usually a very good stepping stone. You may not want to do all of your research there for a variety of reasons, but it's a good place for you to find reference links and to find additional information on all of these topics that may interest you. And so we do have a number of lectures coming up, and even starting today, we're going to begin talking about hardware. So after these introductions, we will just dive into hardware, and in fact, you can see that we have some things up here that we're actually going to start teasing apart and figuring out what all of these things are, what they do. Maybe not each individual little trace or little resistor on it, but we will at least figure out what a number of these things do. Next week, we will do hardware continue, where we'll continue talking about ports, floppy disks, hard drives, memory, all of these sorts of acronyms. And you can certainly see a variety of really scary-looking acronyms on the syllabus, including AGP, ISA, PCI, PCIX, PCI Express, SCSI, I/O devices, all of these things you will actually know in just the next couple of weeks. We will also, of course, be talking about how to shop for a computer. So once you know all of this information, what do all of these parts mean? What do all of these acronyms mean? Well, you should the thing you would want to do is to go out and buy a computer that where you would know what each thing, what each component is or does in the particular computer. And we'll get to that in a little bit more detail when we talk about the problem sets. Then in lecture three, we talk about software, but in fact, we don't talk about software. It's the first of two movie nights that we have here in E1, and we will actually be showing the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley. If you've never seen it, it's actually really interesting dramatization of how Apple and Microsoft sort of started up about 20 years ago or so. So lecture four, the interweb. And so for a long time, this syllabus actually said the internet. And I think David, even before I joined the E1 team, he lectured the E1 course, and he was very rigid about everything had to be perfect and capitalized, and it had to be technically correct, and the internet was there. And so one day, we just started using this term, the interweb, which, I mean, it's not unique to us. Many, many people use it. And so we're starting to make it a little bit more lax. And so the interweb is sort of the mash of what two terms? Any ideas? The internet and the World Wide Web, right. And so if you actually were to go to previous terms or previous semester syllabi and exams, we would always talk about how the internet and the World Wide Web are not the same thing. But now we kind of find that it sort of is the same thing, just maybe not technically the same thing, but just because of the way that that people start talking about it. They just start using it synonymously, and so in the end, of course, when everybody starts to do it, then it does become synonymous, and they are the same thing. So you mash the two together, you get interwebs, and there are a variety of other things as well. I like intertubes to make fun of Senator Ted Stevens and a number of other things, but anyway, that lecture we will talk about the interweb and a variety of topics associated with it, TCP/IP, email, LANs, WANs, netiquette, spam, emoticons, all sorts of things. You can read the entirety of the description here. And of course, lecture five will just be a continued version of that, where we'll keep talking about the internet and go into some more advanced topics. Then in lecture six, which will be pretty much the halfway point for us, we'll go into multimedia. And so we'll talk, of course, about images and sound files and video files and all these things. I've noticed that in recent years, HD starts. We always get a lot of questions on HD, so we'll probably touch on that a little bit. And also, of course, maybe if David will let me go onto a tangent then, I'll talk a little bit about digital photography then as well.
It's true, actually. An interesting survey question right now would be, how many of you only have old school analog TVs that are going to stop working in February? Couple of you? Okay, so perhaps that's because you just haven't gotten around to it. Perhaps that's because you're not quite sure what this all means. And so that's certainly actually a topic that we might very well happen across when it comes time to discuss multimedia. And that too is sort of an example of a technology that's really changed and fairly rapidly in just the past couple of years. And I was just chatting with a colleague in the computer science building today about this old, quote unquote, CRT monitor, the sort of picture tube type monitor that I hadn't touched in probably 3 or 4 years. And I finally powered it up today just to connect a computer to it temporarily, because literally now if you look around the computer science building, it's all LCD monitors. So we'll talk briefly about things like LCDs and plasma, DLP, a lot of the technologies that, again, you kind of get hit with if you're flipping through a Best Buy brochure, that you certainly get hit with if you're talking to a salesperson about these kinds of technologies. So I think one of the side effects too about talking about technologies in general, whether related to the internet or to computers, is that you'll begin to see that there's a lot of crossover, both in sort of the world of computing, the world of, say, home electronics, and even other domains altogether, including, again, the cell phone industry. There's really this convergence. It's all technology. It's all computers at the end of the day, and you're seeing a lot of intermingling of technologies across these several domains. So particularly fun is for me is when we get to lecture 7 and thereabouts. Much of my research in graduate school, for instance, focused on the general domain of security, and more specifically on some of the topics we'll look at in this course specifically. So I spent a few years ago, a summer, at one of the most fun jobs I ever had, which was interning with the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office, where I worked for the forensic investigator there and ultimately took over for a brief amount of time. And this was quite literally a job, I mean, kind of like what you see on like CSI or Law and Order. And they have, in those TV shows, technologies that don't really exist. For instance, that feature that Law and Order always uses when they need to get someone's license plate. So they have this really blurry video, and so they apparently nonetheless have the ability to zoom in to infinite precision on that license plate or on the logo on like the pizza delivery guy's shirt so that they can track someone down. So those kinds of things don't really exist. But in the office I was in, we focused on digital forensics. So the local Mass State Police would bring to our office local hard drives and floppy disks and CDs and sometimes mice and keyboards, which didn't really have a lot of data on them per se. But we would take the media, like CDs and hard drives. We'd make forensic images of these media, and then we would scour them using various tools and software programs, most of them commercial, actually, to actually look for evidence, where evidence is whatever it was the prosecutor that week was actually looking for. Besides being a wonderfully fun job, it was also kind of amusing at times, since I was certainly not impressed with the level of, say, intelligence of some Middlesex County perps. Sometimes our forensic investigations were quite literally as simple as double-clicking on my documents, which is something you're perhaps familiar with already. So we will draw upon some of those topics during these couple of weeks in which we look at security. But beyond looking at forensics and talking more personally about what it is that's actually on your computer, what concerns you should have if you donate a computer, if you throw away a computer, the media is littered with articles over the past few years about people finding hard drives or buying hard drives that have people's social security numbers on them, or medical records, personal files, whatever it is. And so this is actually a real concern now. Even I actually had an iPhone for a couple of weeks because I was trying it out, and I wasn't quite won over yet for various reasons that we don't need to get into the religious debate behind. But I realized just around the time I was going to return it, like, damn, I've been using this thing for 2 weeks. I've had all my like personal email sent to it, all of my contacts for Microsoft Outlook, text messages, and just things that I don't want someone like me finding by just playing around with this thing if I buy it later refurbished or, you know, from the Apple store. Now, fortunately, Apple only relatively recently added a feature to the iPhone's software, because the iPhone's just a computer. It's a fancy computer, but it's just a computer. They only recently added software that allows you to wipe, quote unquote, or scrub the iPhone, whereby the iPhone's hard drive or flash media can literally be overwritten with lots of random zeros and ones, lots of random data, thereby erasing effectively whatever data was on there. But by contrast, most devices today, though fortunately this is decreasingly the case, when you go and drag some files into, say, your recycle bin or trash can, and then go to empty recycle bin or empty trash, what actually happens to those files? So they're kind of still there. And I'm not even talking dragging and dropping to the recycle bin, because almost everyone here probably has realized that dragging them there is just like dropping trash in the trash can. It doesn't actually leave your home until you carry it out the door. And the same goes for the desktop on Mac OS and Windows. But when you do actually click empty trash or empty recycle bin, even then, your computer's not really getting rid of anything. All it's doing is, so to speak, forgetting where that information is. But it's not going through the trouble usually of getting rid of all those zeros and ones that represent your most recent resume or personal email or series of instant messages. And this was largely for performance reasons years ago. It was just, why bother? It's a lot faster just to forget where those bits are and just assume that in time they will probabilistically get overwritten by new data. Not such a good thing if you actually want to delete that data. And it certainly hasn't helped that the likes of Microsoft and Apple, all parties have been guilty of this, when you go to, say, format, erase a hard drive, almost always does the formatting program say, warning, all data will be erased. It's not really accurate, or at least it depends on the semantics of what you mean by erased. Doesn't really happen. So we will talk about these kinds of issues and not only sort of scare you with the existence of these problems, but also proffer some solutions. What tools, what freely available software can you use to not cover your tracks, so to speak, though I guess that too is a matter of semantics, but at least sort of protect what information you might actually be concerned about. Because there was no reason, for instance, for some Apple employee to have access to whatever meaningless drivel was on my iPhone. It just doesn't need to be there. And fortunately, there do exist tools to gain back or reclaim what is your right or your privacy.
You know, along those same lines, have any of you gone to an Apple store to play with one of these iPhones, the new ones or the old ones? You'd be surprised if you haven't actually played with it how many people text message themselves or call themselves, leaving their phone numbers or that of their friends all over the phone, or set up the mail program on the iPhone to actually download their mail. And you can see all of the adult websites that they have been to recently because they're sending them all these emails. And it's just things like that. Many Apple stores are doing or have been doing is they allow you free access to the computer so that you can check your email online, for example. But there's security implications with that as well. When you visit all of these web pages on a public computer, what happens? Even though you may close the window, are you still logged in? Or all of these various other things. So none of this is meant, again, like David said, to scare you, really. But just that these are real threats and real things that you must be aware of and in order to be able to know how to overcome them as well.
Though I will admit, over the years, it has become a fascinatingly useful pedagogical tool to rattle off all the scary things that threaten you and your privacy and safety and security, because you have never seen a room full of students so attentive and so inquisitive as when it actually affects them personally. So I might delve into those scare tactics, but we'll be sure to at least proffer up some solutions so that we're not just leaving you out to dry. What's after that? So it's toward the end of the course where we move away from sort of the lower level details, quite literally, of hardware and what's inside the box to what you can do on top of these boxes, on top of computers and servers. And we'll look at the notion of website development. So one of the skills with which you will exit this course, if you don't already have it now, is how to make websites. Maybe not beautiful websites, because we won't focus so much on the aesthetics or the design issues, even though we will introduce you to the skills with which to sort of do better than, say, I can when it comes to web page design. But we'll look at something called HTML or XHTML, which is the language, so to speak, in which web pages are written. You pull up, for instance, do you mind pulling up google.com? So a website that all of you have probably been to. If you pull up google.com, looks nice and simple. If you go to view page source or some similar option, Google actually does a bit of compression of it. But if Dan scrolls from left to right, this is the code, the programming code, that actually implements the web page you see. And even though this probably does look like the proverbial Greek to you right now, one promise we can make, if you stick around long enough here, is that this will no longer at some point soon look like said Greek. And you'll see that there's actually a structure to it and a style to it. And the fact that it's just so cryptic right now is just because in this form, can it just be more easily and more quickly understood by computers? And it's a lot more standardized, the language, than, say, English or some other spoken language tends to be. So we'll make websites. And we'll come back to that same topic in the context of final projects in a bit. But after that, we'll also look at the idea of programming. So we'd be We'd be over-promising if we said you will exit this course as programmers, because we will spend but one lecture on this idea of programming, whereas you can spend an entire semester, year, career, learning how to program. But what we will do in this course is give you a teaser of it, a taste of sorts, so that you have a sense of what it is software developers, maybe those people down the hall from you at work, actually do. And if nothing else, you'll exit the course with a sense of not only accomplishment, because you will write your own program, albeit in a very playful sandbox, as you'll see, but you will also have a sense for where you can go after the course if you so choose to dive in further to some computer science. In fact, Dan, do you mind clicking the screen back over to me? Though we're on camera, I'm hopeful we can get at least one volunteer to come on up here and do a little demo. Doesn't have to be a speaking role, just needs to be someone good with hitting the keyboard. Covering the mouth instead. Yeah, come on. Okay, what's your name?
Abby.
All right. So what I'm going to show you very briefly here is a programming environment called Scratch. This is something that MIT's Media Lab down the road developed a couple of years ago. They've actually very specifically targeted it at after-school programs and, to be honest, children. But we here at Harvard, both in the college and the extension school, along with some other universities, have kind of usurped what their original vision was for this environment to use it in introductory computer science programming classes. In fact, my course at the college, we're spending this current week having the undergrads use this same environment so that really in the first week of the course, they get this sense of fun and excitement, but also satisfaction, because as you'll see, you can do very interactive things with this environment, and it takes much more time typically in a normal programming course to actually get to the point where you can make things like this. So this is an environment in which programming reduces to dragging and dropping of puzzle pieces, dragging something like this and doing something like this. But if I actually want to move this cat, a so-called sprite on the right-hand side, I'm actually going to do the following forever. And this will be the most uncompelling program you've ever seen. But I made a program. I made the cat move by dragging and dropping these puzzle pieces. Let me actually take things up a notch now and have Abby show us exactly what this thing is capable of. I'm going to go ahead and pull up, let's say, this one here. So this was made by a student of mine just last semester. So anyone here in the spirit of MIT familiar with DDR, Dance Dance Revolution? Okay, so this is, yes, you as well? Okay. So this is Scratch Revolution. You don't have to completely embarrass yourself by hopping up and down here, but instead we'll just use the left arrow key, the right arrow key, the top and the down, so that as colorful boxes scroll up the screen, you'll need to hit the arrow key that corresponds to that color so that they line up just like in DDR on top of those symbols. So.
Work and make it do it. Make sense on a better, faster, stronger.
That don't kill me. Can only make sense stronger. I need you to hurry up, man. Cause I can't wait much longer. I know I got to be right, man. Cause I can't make much stronger. Man, I've been waiting all night, man. That's how long I've been on ya. You know how long I've been on ya. Since Christmas, no absolute. Since OJ had an icy tone.
Okay, I think we can put an end to the awkwardness, but a hand perhaps for Abby. Thank you. So in addition to making interactive games like this, which is precisely something you yourself will be able to do towards semester's end, and I bet you at this point in the term there will be at least one other person in your household, maybe on your email forward list, that you forward these things to, because as you'll see, you'll be able to upload them to MIT's website so that you can actually play them within the confines of a web page rather than even needing to download special software. So besides interactivity, you can also use this environment, as we will, to do sort of animations or stories. And this is perhaps one of my favorites. I'll show you one other example before forging ahead here. You might recognize the song.
Thank you.
So despite the playfulness of the environment, you'll see that we'll be able to use this context to talk about fairly technical concepts like loops and iterations and variables and events and threading and similar such constructs. So we'll actually use what appears to be a fairly playful environment, but to talk about constructs that absolutely come up constantly in programming classes. And this was not, in fact, made by even a small child in an after-school program. That particular one, It's Raining Men, was made by a teaching fellow in another course of mine who's actually on the varsity football team here. So if that adds some weight to exactly what we're doing here. Do you mind flipping over to the rest of the syllabus? Okay, so after programming, here's going to be our second of two movie nights. So one of the most fascinating movies that I've seen made in this sort of space of information technology is this one called Startup.com. And this was the result of perhaps the naivete or of the overzealousness or enthusiasm of a couple of guys several years ago in the height of the dot-com era who thought it would be wonderful to film their rise to fame and fortune as they launched their company called GovWorks.com, which, long story short, was meant to be a website that is your place to go for all of your interactions for local community government, paying your parking tickets, and actually the rest of the compelling features were never quite clear to me. But that was one of the features that they tried sinking millions of dollars into. And they literally had a couple of people follow them with camcorders for a good amount of a year or two. And unfortunately, this filming project sort of coincided not only with the rise of the dot-com era, but also the subsequent decline. And so it's a fascinating look at the true rise and fall of one of these startups, and we'll use it as representative of startups not only back then, but dare say even some now, since it all seems that if you read sort of the valuations of this company and that, despite their lack of profit year after year or quarter after quarter, that perhaps people very quickly forget what happened just 8 or 9 years ago. We'll also cater these events with some delicious popcorn and soda. We've befriended over the years a gentleman by the name of Johnny at Kendall Square. If you happen to work in the area, say hello to Johnny. He works right by the T-stop there. And we give him a good amount of business a couple times a year where we literally go to the T-stop, come back like Santa Claus with really huge bags of popcorn that he makes for us. He also sells pretzels, and we'll take care to bring some goodies like that. And then finally, if that weren't enough, we'll have our exciting conclusion in January after that last film.
Okay, so we will have optional sections in the course. None are set up quite yet, but do keep an eye out on the website. Eventually a link will appear on the left side that will tell you that we have one or more sections available for you to come and perhaps get maybe not so much a lot of hands-on experience, but some hands-on experience, and have a chance for you to ask questions or at least be in a less threatening location. I know what it's like to sit in a lecture hall and have to be the, you know, meekly raise your hand trying to get a question answered. So anyway, this is a more comfortable way for you to get your questions answered or discuss various topics that we will be talking about. But anyway, all of this information will be posted soon, and we will, of course, be referencing it again as we have more information. But since we only meet once a week, we are not the greatest or latest source of information. I did mention before how we do have some pretty fun problem sets coming up, and we do actually start out with some of these in really just getting really into this this material that we have. And in fact, just very soon you will be able to decode and understand what binary is, the ones and zeros that a computer uses to process information. And in fact, you will be manipulating some of that in the first problem set. And so you can see that the name is very tongue-in-cheek, Oh Hi. And this is, again, just internet speak for, or interweb speak for, just saying, you know, hello or welcome. And so we do have a variety of other things. We will be talking more about Oh Hi and where it comes from a little bit later. And a couple of other interesting and notable problem sets are problem set 4, hardware, software, and tubes. No, that is not a typo. Well, I suppose it is a typo, but what people on the interweb do is intentionally misspell the by making it T-E-H. And so tubes, of course, references the internet. And anyway, in this one, you'll actually have to go to a store, a real store, and buy with virtual money, you know, buy in quotations, a computer. And the idea behind this is that you'll understand all of the components that go into it, and you'll have to ask questions to the sales rep and just, I mean, not only, maybe not so much show him how much you know, but show yourself that now you know more than what all of these sales reps at Best Buy or Circuit City do, and that you can certainly outsmart them, and you will know more about what you want than what they will want you to get. Another interesting one is multimedia, the next one. This is actually a contest of sorts, but it's just more fun. You'll notice that at the top of the web page we have an image, and there actually are a variety of images available. And so these aren't terribly representative of what you will be doing, but basically you will be making in this multimedia problem set using Photoshop some image. And we will put all of your images, so long as they are tasteful, please, on the top of the website. And as people go to the website, you know, a new image will appear and yours will show up, which will be just a lot of fun and certainly is a really neat thing when all of a sudden your work is up on a website that a number of people go and visit. But more than that, we will actually also be doing a competition where you will have to design a separate image whose sole purpose is to be put on a mouse pad. And we'll have a competition between all of the submissions, and the best mouse pad will get printed. And so that's certainly also very neat. And so the thing is, we do this every year, and we have so many mouse pads now, but they're always really, really well done. And the idea is that you will be doing a mouse pad that says that you survived computer science, you won, because just as David had mentioned before, there is a lot of information in this course. And to bring up this fire hose analogy, and if you haven't understood yet, we're going through some of this stuff very quickly. Maybe not right now, but pretty soon when we only talk for 2 lectures or 4 hours total about the internet, or 2 hours about multimedia, there is a lot of stuff to be compressed. So if you do make it through the course, which you will, don't worry, you will have survived computer science E1. And so there are a variety of other problem sets as well, website developments, where you may not be necessarily developing your own website, but you will be looking to see what, or you'll be answering questions based on designing a website. And by then, you will understand what a lot of this stuff means. For example, this is the source for the syllabus webpage. You will understand what all of these somewhat cryptic tags mean, and you will be able to fix them and repair them such that you will get a working webpage. And so speaking of web pages, though, we do actually have a pretty interesting final project, but I'll let David explain that one.
So in the course's final project, as promised, not only will you exit the course having produced your own website, what we're also going to do is make it as real world as possible. So what we will do at course's end is provide you with an account, a username and a password, on a third-party commercial web host. So long story short, the way that most relatively small or medium-sized websites are hosted these days is that the owners don't go out and buy their own servers, they don't go and pay an ISP per se, rather they just pay someone who's already gone through all of that work, already has procured a whole bunch of servers, wired them together, connected to them to the internet, connected them to electricity and backup power supplies and the like, all of that kind of hardware detail, and you simply end up paying them $10 a month, $20 a month, $100 a month, depending on what level of quality you want to pay for, and they host your website for you. All you, the owner of that website, need to do is actually create it, and then you will sort of bundle it up in like a zip file or something like that, upload it, so to speak, to a server, and then it will live on this third-party hosted server. And so what we'll do is, rather than even use Harvard University's infrastructure, fas.harvard.edu, we will provision a third-party hosting company, provide you with accounts on that, and to make it even more sort of fun or engaging, actually have you, for the total cost of maybe $6.95, maybe $9.95, buy your own domain name, whether it's your own vanity domain like davidmalin.com, or insert your own name there, or something completely silly, but you'll actually host, in a very real-world sense, your own website, and you can create your own email addresses within that account. So you can do pretty much anything that you might find on real-world websites within this context. So more on that later in the semester, but it should be a fun culmination of a lot of the material that you'll have absorbed at that point in the course. So I did want to comment, and I think both of us on sort of internet-isms that we've already uttered. So despite the implication earlier that when Dan joined the course, there was a decline in the technical accuracy of the course, what we actually mean by that is that not only will we continue to sort of push as much technical information at you, but in a manner that's sort of in layman's terms and easily absorbed, but also we will intersperse, partly because we think it's fun and partly because you can't, it's increasingly hard to avoid it, some of these internet isms, or these memes that circulate, those internet forwards where you look at it and you're like, who has the time to even write these things up? Case in point, if you wouldn't mind flipping to my screen, these things are all the rage over the past couple of years. Lolcats, L-O-L. So some of you have probably have kids or friends who at some point might have written the acronym L-O-L, which stands for laughing out loud. So if someone maybe laughed out loud or just kind of thought that, haha, that was funny, they'll often instant message someone or email someone LOL and similar such things. You know of emoticons probably, like stupid little smiley faces and all the many variants of those. So one of the reasons too that we do want to intersperse the course with these is not only to sort of break the tension or at least make you feel, whew, we're not always talking about bits and hard drives and floppy disks and these kinds of things, but also because honestly, there's this fascinating societal trend these days for not just the sort of geeks in their basement to kind of adopt this language, but for you to see it in articles. I mean, you see it in emails people are sending. You see technical jargon, maybe not so much cats on the evening news like this, but what we at least hope to do, similar in spirit to empowering you in general when it comes to computers and the internet, is also help you discern for yourselves what is actually legitimate sort of technical jargon, for instance, and what is just silliness that people with too much free time have kind of adopted and sort of spread for better or for worse. And if nothing else, you might get a good laugh out of it. This, for instance, is sort of the canonical lolcat, I can has cheeseburger, question mark. If you'd really like to waste a lot of time, you can go to icanhascheeseburger.com, and every 4 or so hours, you can have one of these pushed to your email inbox or some similar place on your desk. So there will be some of you who perhaps love this sort of thing, others who perhaps like me sometimes, but I'll admit I am increasingly, and Dan is sort of increasingly winning me over to this world, even though I'm about 2 years behind. On any internet forward that anyone has received in this room, I get it like 2 years later and then think it's funny. So I just learned recently all these sort of internet isms that apparently were all the rage 2 years ago, and I'm just now sort of catching up. So perhaps I'm more on that side of things now, but we shall see. I did think that I would mention one sort of related notes on Dan's mention of the problem set, in which you'll go into an actual computer store and shop with some number of thousands of virtual dollars that problem set will give you. It was sort of interesting, even for me, just the other day, to go into the Apple store, and I was buying at the time a MacBook Air, which is a very sexy device, but for work, so it wasn't complete indulgence, and I was checking out, and the two girls at the desk, both of them, sort of in succession, asked, oh, do you want to pay us the, you know, whatever it is, $250 Apple Care Protection Plan, all of those upsells that if you sort of read the academic literature are always statistically not a worthwhile expenditure of your money, because the margin on those things is 100% for the store, and typically the failure rate, certainly for devices that don't have moving parts these days, or at least many of them, are increasingly low. The salesperson kept asking me, are you sure? I mean, she even said to the girl next to her, this guy's buying an SSD MacBook Air, and he doesn't want the Apple Care protection. Now, mind you, this was sort of weird on a couple of levels. One, they were sort of making fun of me at the desk while I was checking out. And two, I mean, it wasn't really the best endorsement of their product to sort of be scared that I was buying something without the insurance policy. So what is this? Well, one of the neat things about the MacBook Air and other new laptop models is that they don't have hard drives per se with spinning platters with moving parts. Rather, they have what's called flash memory, which still stores zeros and ones, but without the need to actually spin something around. It just stores data essentially as electrical charges. So in that sense, it's more robust in principle because there's nothing to move and wear and break down, but for some reason they couldn't believe I was going to exit this store with this beautiful new laptop without giving them an additional $250. So having taken E1 or taught E1, you know, I knew what questions to ask. And so I asked them very sort of jokingly, because I had no intention of paying for this, whatever their answer was, but I was sort of fascinated that they couldn't even back up this insistence. I just asked simply, well, why? What's the failure rate of these things? They're like, oh, we don't know. So apparently that was sort of a reminder for me that there's got to be people out there, sort of, you know, friends of mine, or my, I'm not allowed to use them in examples anymore specifically, but my parents in general, who might actually sort of buy into that because either one, they don't really know what it means to have an SSD hard drive, so maybe they really do need this protection plan, or at least they don't necessarily know what questions to ask, or they just assume this person knows more than them. But I think you'll find increasingly in the, in society, in stores, you push a little harder on some of these gurus, and you'll find, wow, with just a little bit of empowerment on your part, can you finally discern for yourself what makes sense and what really does not. So one word on lectures, too, before we forge ahead and also take a break. We do have this camera in the back of the room, and even though this course is not being offered via distance education, so to speak, that is, we don't have students tuning in from other cities and states, we did decide to film the course to make it available not only to you all, if you, for instance, you can't make some lecture because of work or other reasons, or if you simply would like to review material, which we found is a really interesting sort of side effect of making these available. Folks tend to like to slow me down, at least, by sort of pausing and rewinding, because I do tend to speak quickly, but we are also sort of as a sort of more fundamentally interesting or pedagogical project making the course available, as Dan mentioned earlier, on computerscience1.tv via podcast, whereby we make these videos available to really anyone on the internet who wants to tune in, and we don't really field questions and answer technical support inquiries, no matter how many emails we tend to get as a result of this. We don't grade homeworks and such, but we figured we're presenting this information. Harvard has all of these wonderful resources. It's at least a little something good that we can do sort of to make it available in opening our doors virtually to those who might not be as fortunate to hang out in a campus like this. So the upside is that you'll be able to download the course's videos, watch them on laptops. You can even be a true geek, and whether you have an iPod or a Mac or a an iPhone, I don't frankly know why you would want to do this, but you can take me with you on your iPhones, Dan, as well, if nothing else, just to impress your friends. Though I think it's a scary day if we get to the point where society's walking around watching computer science classes on their phones and other such devices. But it's possible, but more realistically, perhaps, can you just download the videos ultimately to your desktop, to laptop, and so forth. So we hope that you get some use out of that. So for filming's reason, we're going to need to take a break in a moment, but what we'd like to do is at least make it feel a little more comfortable in here. So if you'd humor us for just a moment, allow us to ask that you turn to the person to your left and or right, if they're close enough, say hello, maybe ask them why are you taking the course, or maybe why are you not taking the course, and just so that you make a friend in the course and feel a little more comfortable here. So if you would. All right, welcome back. So, bits. You all know, even if you don't quite know how your computers work, that at the end of the day, everything in your computer boils down to zeros and ones somehow. So why is that? Well, whereas as humans, we kind of deal with zeros and ones and twos all the way up to nine. So the so-called decimal systems, computers can only understand and store the numbers zero and one. And this was largely for physical or electronic reasons, because it turns out it's very easy to represent a zero or a one just by having no electricity present or some electricity present, or in a more real world sense, having a light bulb off to represent the notion of a zero, or a light bulb on to represent the notion of a one. And it turns out with just those basic building blocks, can you actually build up from that to represent not just the values zero and one, but also via some clever use of these so-called bits, two and three and four and 10,000 and 20,000 and even letters of the alphabet. So how might this work? Well, back in the day, I might have had an actual light bulb with one of those little metal things that you can pull down and the light bulb goes on, pull it again, and the light bulb goes off. Well, I thought we would instead, being a computer science course, simulate said light bulb with this here PowerPoint slide. So here is an off light bulb. It's not even connected to anything. And therefore, it's going to represent what we'll call a zero or a false or an off. Any of these sorts of terms are synonymous so far as we're concerned. But if I throw the switch, so to speak, it becomes a one and goes on. So on, off, zero, one, zero, one. I mean, those are the basic building blocks. Now, inside of an actual computer, there aren't these big incandescent light bulbs, but rather things called transistors and capacitors, more electrical engineering terms and type things that still store electricity and send signals on and off, but do it at a much more microscopic scale. And that's why you can fit these days so many millions or tens of millions of them on a CPU or other such devices. So how can we actually build up from these basic principles and do something a little more interesting? Well, it turns out that the binary system and the system that computers use is little different from what you learned back in grade school. In fact, just to pick a blatantly simple example, consider for the moment this value 123. Well, why does that number represent the value 123? Well, if you think way back, you probably remember somewhere back there that this is the ones column, so to speak. This is the tens column, and then, of course, the hundreds column. Well, why then does this sequence of digits, 1, 2, 3, represent the number we know as 123? Well, let's do out the math. So we have a 3 in the ones column, so that's like 3 times 1, plus a 2 in the tens column, and that's like 2 times 10. So already the running count is like 23, so 23, plus a 1 in the 100s column, so that's 1 times 100. And though we seem to have kind of gotten back to where we started, the total value is 123. But the principles we applied involve these sort of placeholders, these column values. Well, it turns out in the computer's world and in the so-called binary system, bi meaning 2, decimal system, dec meaning 10, we have just different placeholders. But otherwise, the principles are exactly the same. In the world of binary, we have the ones column still, but then the twos column, then the fours column, the eights column, the sixteens, and so forth. So instead of having powers of two, so to speak, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, we instead have powers of, instead of having powers of 10, we have powers of 2 here. Well, it's not all that interesting to only talk about bits and these zeros and ones in a vacuum, because the highest you can count with just a single bit is obviously 1, so we need more bits, it seems, if we want to count higher than the value 1. So it turns out that computers tend to find it more useful, humans tend to find it more useful, if computers actually deal not in individual bits usually, but in sequences of bits. As sequences of 8 often is the typical value, because 8 bits, as you know, is called a byte. So that's all a byte is. B-Y-T-E is just a sequence of 8 bits. So let's go ahead and assume that we have a sequence of 8 bits, or to make it more real, a sequence of 8 light bulbs in a row. What values can we represent with 8 light bulbs if we have the ability to turn some on and off? Well, if we have 8 light bulbs that are completely off at the moment, what value are we representing if we apply those same ideas of placeholders, column values, to this example here? So 8 off light bulbs. Pretty easy, right? 0, so right, so it's 0 times 128 plus 0 times 64 plus 0 times 32, dot, dot, dot. There's nothing going on there. It represents the value 0. But if we pull the chain, so to speak, of that rightmost light bulb and turn it on, we're ultimately representing, albeit with 8 bits this time, the value 1, just like before. So if we now turn on another one to the left but turn off that rightmost one, we're representing what value now? So a 2. All right, how about 3? What light bulbs are going to be on in the next row that appears? So we need the value 3. Well, we need a 1 in the 2's column, and then a 1 in the 1's column, because that's going to be 1 times 2 plus 1 times 1 is going to give me a total of 3. And so we now have 2 light bulbs on. And finally, we'll end with just one more example here. What happens now when I flip another switch, so to speak, and I add 1 to this running count? Well, just like in the decimal system, when you have like the value 99 and you add 1 in that context, well, the 9 on the right becomes a 0, and the next 9 becomes a 0, and then you, so to speak, carry the 1. Well, the same idea happens here. This guy is going to become a 0, that is off. This guy is going to become a 0, that is off. So we're going to carry the 1, carry the light bulb, and we now have this particular sequence of light bulbs. So who cares? Why is this actually useful? So if we now have the ability to store atomic values like 0 and 1, but we can group them together, say in units of 8, and represent larger values, we have the ability to count much higher than 1. In fact, if we have 8 light bulbs, or 8 bits, a byte, what is the largest possible value we can represent? So if you throw all of these light switches on, so thereby illuminating an entire row of 8 light bulbs, you get 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and so forth. If we then do the math, 128 plus 64 plus 32, we get not 256, but close, but Yeah, so 255. So if we have 8 light bulbs, the total number of permutations of light bulbs on and off is, 256. If you do the quick math, there's 2 possible values here, on or off, 2 possible values here, 2 possible values here. So that's 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, dot, dot, dot. So 2 to the 8th power, or 2 times itself, 8 times, gives you 256. But remember, the smallest possible value you can represent with 8 bits is going to be 0 if they're all off. So if you throw them all on, you can, represent a total number, a total of 256 values. But if one of those starts you at 0, the largest one you can represent is 255. All right. So we've got the ability to count at least as high as 255. It's not a stretch of the imagination to assume that we can have not just 1 byte of bits, but maybe 2 bytes, or 3 or 4 bytes, and with more bits can we represent even larger and larger values. But let's consider a really cheap calculator that can only count as high as 8 bits allow, the value 255. Well, what is inside a calculator? Even like the cheapest kind you might get at Radio Shack or Staples, well, you've got some kind of memory, probably, and you're probably generally familiar with the idea of memory, or RAM, random access memory, and that's where stuff gets stored while you're interacting with the device, similar to what using your computer. Well, if you now push the number 2, the number 2 appears on the screen. Why? Well, presumably there's some kind of memory in that device that's remembering, so to speak, that you just punched in the number 2, and that's something we'll call RAM. Then you hit plus, then you hit, say, 3, hit enter, and now the value five appears on the screen. Well, why? What has happened? Well, clearly the RAM, the memory, has gotten updated with this current value of 5. But what happened before that? Well, there was probably some chunk of memory that stored the first value, 2. There was another chunk of memory that stored the second value, 3. When you hit plus and then the equal sign, something inside the calculator, let's call it the brains of that thing, the CPU, central processing unit, looked at this memory, looked at that memory, was hardwired to know, take this guy and this guy, add them together and put the result in this chunk of memory, and voila, we have a calculator, or more generally, a computer. So this is precisely what computers are good at, operating on very basic values, little pieces of information stored in memory, and then performing some basic, often arithmetic operation like addition, subtraction, division, multiplication, and in other basic building blocks still. And the reason that we have much more complicated devices than those cheap calculators these days, like iPhones, iPods, laptops, desktop computers, is just because we've continued to build over the years on top and on top of all of these very basic, components, so that we now can start to take for granted that this computer, this calculator, this device just knows how to add, it knows how to subtract, it knows how to do all of these basic things because we've sort of advanced beyond some of those basic principles. And so one of the goals here was really to tear the hood off of that basic idea of computation and what it is to be a CPU or a piece of memory, to begin to give you a sense of what really is going on inside of that computer. Now, unfortunately, a CPU, the brains of a computer, has got to be connected to other things to be useful. In the case of the calculator, it's connected to buttons and a screen, which makes it useful. In the case of a computer, it's got to talk probably to your monitor, your keyboard, your mouse, maybe your printer, so that a human, you, can actually interact with it. And so for that, we need like a central artery system, to draw a physiological analogy there. We need something to plug the CPU into so that it can talk to other components. And what we're going to do is call that device, that central artery system, the motherboard.
Since sizes in the world, they tend to call them logic boards. So it's, for whatever reason, Apple just wanted to be special or different. And in this case, it is just exactly the same thing. And you may recognize this one in particular is blue, but many of them that you see frequently are, in fact, green. And they always have these little traces that actually cause these bits to travel among different things. But if I were to just show this up on a much bigger scale, you can see that there are, there are a number of connections on here, and all of these things perform different functions, or many different things are supposed to plug into each. But rather than focus on this for right now, let's just turn it over and try to zoom in on some of this stuff. All right, so this right here, this big mess is actually where the CPU connects. And you can tell just because it's on the opposite side of this very large connector, and usually, not all the time, this very large square connector indicates the CPU. But anyway, if we take a look, you can see the solder points where the machines or the people that manufacture these motherboards or logic boards actually solder the connections from the opposite side using a little bit of melted metal onto this side so that they can't come off. If I were to pull on the connector, it wouldn't actually come off. But coming from each of these, you can see that there's little tiny wires called traces that come from very many different places, not only from the CPU, but from all of these other connectors that connect to just about everything else. So rather than try to follow one of these to see what it does, because that's getting into some fine detail that really doesn't make any difference, you can follow them and get to something like this, which are just a collection of transistors or resistors or very small resistors that modify the electric current in some way. But we don't really care about what happens at that sort of detail. What we care more about are these connectors themselves. And so I'll soon pass around this logic board, but you'll see that there are a number of internal connectors, like here where the CPU goes. There's some RAM slots here, a few other connectors over here. But also we have external connectors that you can see on the side. Sorry if it's a little bit blurry, but these are the ports that you would typically see on the outside of your computer that you would plug in the peripherals to, the peripherals such as your monitor, your keyboard, your mouse, your speakers, for example. And all of these things, even though we don't care on the trace level where everything is connected, you can infer from the shape of each of these connectors, not only on the interior side, but also on the exterior side, what they do, what they are for, and why we have them. So first, unfortunately, I don't have a CPU to show you that it does actually fit in the slot, but a CPU goes right here, like I said. And the CPU is what? Yes, the central processing unit. You can think of it, if you were to make an analogy to the human body, it's sort of the brain. It does all of the processing for the computer. And so in this way, you would find a lot of traces that come from various locations on the logic board or on the motherboard to the CPU, just because there are a number of things that have to be connected to it. So then over here, we have some other connectors. These blue things, what do you think these are for? Yeah, RAM slots. And so what is RAM? This is a big question. Yeah, random access memory, but what does it do? Yes, it's yeah, exactly. It's a temporary storage. So there's we'll get into this in just a little bit, but it is where a lot of data for the CPU is stored. So you wouldn't just have let's see. So in order to speed things up, you wouldn't just directly input the ones and zeros from the hard drive or from some other location directly into the CPU for reasons why we'll get into either at the end of this lecture or in the next lecture. But instead, you store them in some temporary location, RAM. And in this, so this RAM doesn't actually, this RAM stick doesn't actually fit there, but let's pretend that it does. You actually put RAM sticks in this location, and they are this sort of central repository for information that your CPU can process. But what are some of the, let's see, what are some examples of RAM that some of you have? How do we measure it? Yes. Yes, so recently now we've been doing gigabytes, but for a long time we've been doing megabytes and even kilobytes. But what are these prefixes? So hopefully all of you can recognize that there is the word byte in there, which means what? Right, 8 bits. But there's a variety of these prefixes as well. I mentioned kilo and mega and giga. But what do these mean? Right, it indicates the quantity. So kilo, for example, is 1,000 of something. So if we have kilobytes, then what we are saying is that we have some RAM stick that is measured in thousands of bytes. Similarly, mega would be 1,000,000, and giga would be 1,000,000,000 with 9 zeros. So it gets to be a little bit more complex than this because the way we count in decimal is different than binary, but we'll get to that in just a little bit. For now, realize that when we're talking about we have gigabytes of RAM, either 1 gigabyte of RAM, 2 gigabytes of RAM, we have 1,000,000,000 or 2 billion or 4 billion bytes of RAM that is accessible in your computer. And so most modern computers, if not all, usually come with at least 1 gigabyte of RAM now. But the more RAM you have, what might you be able to infer if you have more RAM? Yes. Right, so I mentioned that you can use this RAM, or the computer uses this RAM as a sort of central storage, or just a temporary storage. And so on a higher level, what this means is that the computer stores the programs or the bytes that it is working with at that particular moment in time. So if you have more RAM, you can infer that you would be able to run more programs, at least more quickly. And well, there are, of course, details that get in the way of this sort of thing, but we'll talk about that in just a little bit. So we were talking about temporary storage, but what is permanent storage? Right, so a hard drive. So I actually have a hard drive here, and one of the things that we like to do is actually tear it open so you can see the insides and what makes it run and what makes it click. But unfortunately, there's one screw in here that we just couldn't get out, and it took John, David, and I, and we still weren't able to do it. So we'll try to have it for you next week. But just in general, you can see that this is the hard drive, and on it, there's a bunch of information, but right here, can you read how much it says? It says 10.2 gigabytes, which tells you basically the capacity of the hard drive. But what I really wanted to show you was on the side here, how there are ports and connectors on the side of the hard drive, just like there are on the internal location of the logic board. And so conveniently, you'll notice that we have some connectors that look exactly the same. On the hard drive here matches pretty conveniently with this connector on the logic board as well. So that it means that it's basically just a location for us to make a mess of this cable, but this is an IDE cable. This connector is called an IDE, and so or you can also call it ATA, and basically all you do is you just connect the cable from the hard drive onto its location on the motherboard. And so if I can get it on here. Okay, there we go. And so you can, if when I pass around the logic board, you'll be able to see a little bit better, but each of these connectors are labeled. And so these two connectors right here are labeled as IDE1 and IDE2. I'll go ahead and pass it around now.
If it makes it a little more real, so that motherboard was literally from an old computer of mine, and the reason that it's no longer in my computer was I was out of town once. I had asked a sweet friend of mine to water my plants for me. Literally, the one time she does this nice favor for me, she decided to sit down at my computer, which is kind of on 24/7 because I connect to it remotely, because she just wanted to check her email. It was totally fine with me. But my computer, for the 2-3 years I had it, chose that afternoon to completely die. She called me on the phone in tears, and it was not her fault at all. It's kind of hard to break a computer just by checking your email. It was purely a coincidence, but it just turned out that the motherboard had been fried somehow. It's kind of inexplicable, so even people like us sort of don't understand why things break sometimes. Sometimes there's no recourse other than in that case, and this is going to be like one of those Jerry Seinfeld Amex commercials, I pulled out my Amex, which I had used to buy this particular motherboard and CPU. Amex is a nice, like, extend your warranty by a year kind of thing. Called Amex because this was literally month 13 on my 12-month warranty. Amex was kind enough to send me not the new motherboard because they didn't really care to get involved in the details, but they credited my account. The deal was, though, I would keep the CPU, which was perfectly fine, and that's why it's not actually in the motherboard. It's still in my computer. But that was very much a live, really nice at the time, motherboard. That's all I got. All right.
Okay, anyway, so back to motherboards.
I thought that made it more compelling.
Well, hardly. So we have here what I did basically while David was blabbing about ones and zeros. I just Googled around for images of motherboards, and there are a variety of motherboards available. So when you buy a computer, of course, you get a motherboard pre-installed in it. But if you're a computer enthusiast, what you can do is just buy a case, buy a motherboard and buy all of the components that plug into it, and then just build your own computer. And so this here is an example of just a bare motherboard, just like the one that's being passed around now, but it's a little bit more modern. In fact, it's a lot of bit more modern. But you can see some similarities. You can see that, what do these look like right here? Yeah, RAM slots. And of course, there's a big honking thing right there, but what do you think that means? It's where the CPU goes, right. And so there are a variety of other connections as well, but What's particularly interesting now, I think, are the ports that we have on this side. So lots of stuff here. But I think one of the best ways to make what a computer does more real is just to understand what all of these ports do. So let's start at the far leftmost two ports. What do you think those two ports are? Keyboard and mouse, but what is it called? There's of course some crazy acronym. I heard it, I think. PS2. Yep, a PS2 port. So these are sort of old and archaic, but many new logic boards do have them because people like to hold on to their old and archaic mice and keyboards. Hopefully you don't have a mouse that looks like this anymore, in which case you'd have to upgrade. But you can still plug in some older mice and keyboards to those PS2 ports on the left side. And so you notice that they're color-coded. And in fact, these older ones are meant to be plugged into either a keyboard or a mouse, but you can't swap them. So you'd have to take a look at the plug on your respective keyboard or mouse to figure out which one is which. So how about these two rectangular ports that are to the right of the PS2 ports? What do those look like? Sorry? Yep, USB. And what is USB for? Yeah, universal serial bus. Good. But what do you plug into it? Yeah, all sorts of stuff. So printers, cameras, more modern keyboard and mice go into USB. Let's see, you can even get crazy and plug in TV tuner cards, for example, so you can watch TV over on your computer. A variety of things can be plugged into USB. And so these are representative of, there are actually different versions of USB. There's a USB 1 and USB 2. The physical port connector is the same, but what's the difference between these 1 and 2? Right, the speed. And so the USB 2 one being a higher number somehow luckily indicates that it is a faster port. In fact, it's quite a bit faster. It's 480 megabits per second as opposed to, 11, I think, is the original spec. Who cares? I know, that's old and dead. But anyway, they are actually now coming out with the USB 3 standard, which is supposed to be super fast and all awesomeness and everything, but I don't think there's a lot of information yet on that. So how about this connector that's to the right of these these USB connectors? So it's not exactly a coax, but it looks like it's a component connector. And you can see, looks like you can see right through the connector to the logic board, so it may not actually be used for anything. I guess we'd have to look through the specs on this logic board to see. But usually this is for connecting, it's like a component connection. So if you have a video game system or even a TiVo, usually that's how it connects to a TV. So you might infer that this motherboard has some sort of video input capabilities or maybe video output. Maybe this is some way for you to connect this particular computer or this motherboard to your TV so that you can see it on your TV. So how about this big ugly one right here? Yeah, VGA. So a lot of connectors now use VGA. So let's see if I have one here. So even projectors, monitors, all of these sorts of visual displays use this VGA connector, which you can see up there. And so this is a very, very common one. There are now new standards that are coming out that are trying to replace VGA, but they're not incredibly popular yet, especially with projectors. And what are some of these newer technologies that are coming out to replace VGA? HDMI is one of them. DVI is another one. I think there's even some further ones or some other ones than that. But this even does have an HDMI connector, which is right below. So if your monitor happens to support an HDMI connector, you would be able to use an HDMI connection, a more modern connection than the VGA. But why, other than size, might one of these DVI or HDMI connections be advantageous over the VGI connector or VGA connector rather? So resolution and refresh rate, that really depends. I think what I'm getting more towards is that these newer technologies are digital. So the signal that's sent over the wire, over this HDMI or DVI connector is digital rather than being converted to some analog signal. And so every time you convert the signal, whether it's from digital to analog or analog back to digital, you're going to get some sort of loss. And so Usually when you use the VGA connectors, there's a little bit of loss, and it's, people argue that it's not as sharp, for example, as using just a pure digital connection. But certainly there seems something worthwhile, even if we don't get into the nitty-gritty details about this sort of conversion, that it seems advantageous to not do a conversion on the signal at all, to just let it be completely coherent and digital to the end result.
Can I pose a question that might be on some folks' mind?
Sure.
So I'm getting a little overwhelmed with all these acronyms, VGA, HDMI, RCA, PS2. How important is it to actually know what all these things expand to?
So it's perhaps not super important to know exactly what all of these acronyms mean, but it is important in the sense that one of the things that we would like you to do is when you go home, just tear out all of the plugs on your computer without looking where they go and try to plug them back in, see if you can figure out what everything does. And if you're too afraid to do it on your computer, then go knock on your friend's door and see if, while they're in the bathroom, just quickly take it all apart and say, oh, I don't know what happened. Let me try to fix it for you. I'm an E1. I'm this great student now. So then this way, though all of these acronyms are a bit inundating and crazy, it is helpful to know, just one second, it is helpful to know what plug goes where, what these plugs do, so that you would be able to tell, oh, here's a cable coming from my monitor. It must be either VGA or HDMI. I should look for one of these connectors. Of course, you can just plug in whatever fits into whichever port, because obviously not all the ports are compatible, but still, it's helpful to know what you're plugging into computer. There's a certain power behind knowing what each of these ports and connectors do. Yes? What do they stand for? I have no idea.
Let's play Stump Dan. You don't need to know. Video graphics array is VGA. And HDMI, I don't know that one actually myself.
We don't need it.
Let's Google. High definition multimedia interface.
Certainly nothing we know would you be expected to know for, say, the course's exam. And as Dan said, more important is the spirit of these things, what they do. And it's sort of less interesting trivia if one can actually say what they are. The upside of knowing what the acronyms are, though, of course, is that it kind of gives you a hint as to what they're all about.
So I was showing VGA connectors and HDMI connectors, but this is a DVI connector, digital video interface. It's actually, to give you a comparison of the size, it's a little bit bigger than a VGA connector, but it is digital rather than being an analog connector. So some would say it is superior then. Okay.
Where else do you find HDMI adapters, by the way?
HDMI adapters, you see them a lot in video components as well. So a lot of new TVs have HDMI. I believe even game consoles such as the PlayStation 3 has an HDMI connection. So it's not strictly for computers. It's more a generic video interface. And I believe in some cases can transmit sound as well. So you can reduce the number of cables that you have connected to your various devices. And so it is more useful than just being a purely computer interface. Okay. Any other questions before I inundate you? Yes. So the difference between DVI and HDMI, I believe, besides being able to carry sound, is, and I'm sure there are more technical differences as well, but is really the size mainly. The HDMI connector is considerably smaller than the DVI connector. But for various reasons, it is actually moving into this AV or this audiovisual realm with TVs and video games and such, whereas DVI didn't really make headway in that sort of realm. So HDMI is more generic.
One anecdote worth noting, which is more the realm of consumer electronics, you will see ridiculously expensive cables out there these days. Like at Best Buy, you could spend $40, $50+ for a high quality, super insulated HDMI cable. But as Dan said, HDMI cables are digital. They carry zeros and ones. And digital stuff either gets there or it doesn't. It doesn't kind of get there or kind of get there at partial quality. So I would encourage you, the next time you go out and buy your very expensive TV, not to be upsold into the monster cables of the world, but rather go on the internet somewhere, find yourself a $6 HDMI cable, and save yourself the difference. So there too, sort of one of these side effects of understanding what it means to be analog, what it means to be digital, because there is a premium that one pays for sometimes for not
understanding those
and just
things.
To hit this idea home, so one of these tech blogs, if you're not familiar, it's basically just the website where you can go and see lots of tech news. One of these is Engadget, and we'll reference Engadget quite a bit, but there was a very interesting article back in March about how even audiophiles, you know, the people that are die hard about how every sound must be exactly so, can't actually tell the difference between these ridiculously expensive monster cables and coat hangers. So they plugged in monster cables into two devices, basically from headphones into a stereo system or a CD player, and they listened to it. Then they unplugged the monster cable and plugged in a coat hanger instead, and you can't tell the difference. So certainly don't be fooled into spending 10% or more of the cost of your super expensive TV to getting some of these cables. Do the research first, because it's... just because it's gold-plated and all this crap really doesn't mean anything. It's just a way for them. It's just pure profit.
I like this quote here. All agreed that the hanger sounded excellent.
Oh. That's right. So this is actually really free. So a really, really neat website. So I do hope you take a look at this. Anyway, moving on. So there are just a couple more interesting ones, interesting ports for me to point out. So this large-ish looking telephone jack up top of this column here. What do you think this is? Yeah, RJ45. It's an Ethernet connection. It's where it's a way for you to connect to your interwebs. Basically, you can connect this to your home router if you don't have a wireless connection. But we'll talk more about this stuff when we get to the internet lecture. More USB ports, just because they are much more... they're very, very useful now. We have two more things. My manual laser pointer here. And to the right of that, we just have a bunch of audio connections. I'm going to hand wave because you generally have to, they're color coded, but you generally have to look at the color coding on the logic board to figure out which is for headphones, which is for speakers, which is for microphone, which is line in, and whatever other junk there are. But so this was just one example of a logic board, but there are pretty much every electronics device does have some main logic board or some main motherboard where all of the data flows through it. And so even though this motherboard is relatively the same size as the logic board that's being passed around right now, there are much smaller ones as well. So this is a much smaller logic board called a Pico ITX. And that's just, you don't have to remember that. That's just the name of the size. They're all named based on the standard sizes that they have. So that one, I believe, is an ATX motherboard, and the one you just saw was an ATX, and you really don't have to worry about the acronym again. It's just representative of the size of the logic board so that you can buy a case and figure out what sizes of logic boards fit inside of that case. But anyway, to come back to this, you can see that the size of this Pico ITX logic board compared to the size of a standard playing card is actually, it's pretty surprising. This is a very, very small device, but it still manages to fit what on it? What do we see on this logic board, even though it's a little fuzzy? VGA, Ethernet, yep. Yeah, we see a CPU right here. So this is what the CPU looks like directly on the logic board. We see some connectors up there, probably for some storage. We can see some other various connectors internally, but this actually does a variety of things, this one particular type of logic board. Let's see. So what does all of this mean, though? How does this all come together? So here again, I have another logic board. This came, so just to give you an idea, when I was in college and very shortly thereafter, I worked at MIT's IS&T department, or the Information Systems and Technology. One of my jobs was to pick up the phones and say, hello, you know, thanks for calling, what's your problem, or whatever, try to fix their problem. And I would try to sound a little bit more excited than that. It's sometimes kind of hard. Yes, question.
And now you take a question now after that question. Setup?
It's suspense. Are these motherboards different from Mac motherboards? So, yes and no. Usually Apple tries to lay out their motherboards very rigidly such that it's designed specifically for their casing, whereas PC manufacturers usually, and I'm generalizing here, tried to make them much easier to connect items to. So this, for example, this motherboard came straight out of a Dell computer, and you can see that there, each of these things are spaced pretty evenly so that you can tell what each of these connectors are. And even though they didn't try very hard to make the to hide some of this clutter in the top of the logic board, it's still laid out in such a way that it's easy to plug stuff into it, whereas Apple logic boards tend to be a little bit more convoluted, or that's perhaps the wrong word. They're at least a little bit more complex to plug stuff into. So anyway, going back to this story, one of the things that I had to do eventually was to do hardware repairs on Apple and Dell machines. And I must say that don't listen to what anybody says. Every machine fails. Apple's, Dell's, IBM, there really don't seem to be any that last any longer than the others. Some specific models have problems, but in general, they're all pretty much the same. But anyway, so I stole a logic board out of someone's motherboard or someone's computer just so I could take a few photos for last year. But we can see that overall, this is a fairly new logic board. It looks very much the same, except for a couple of weird differences. You'll notice that right here, these are what? These connectors are for what? Yeah, for RAM. So you can tell because they're fairly long. But you'll notice that some are vertical and some are at this sort of strange angle. Why might that be? I'll give you a hint. It's not for ease of access because it was really hard getting these stupid little connectors. Right, double channel. So there does exist this technology where you can actually try to pump data into more than one stick of RAM at a time. So you may hear me reference these as sticks of RAM, and it's really just referencing the same RAM card. I mean, there's a lot of variety in how people call these RAM cards, but I like to call them sticks of RAM for whatever reason. Anyway, what you have to do is plug in two sticks of RAM so that the computer can address both at the same time, so that the computer can communicate with both at the same time, where this the idea is that it speeds it up slightly so that it can try to distribute how it's reading and writing these bits from the CPU or to the CPU from or to this RAM. So if you see a logic board like this, most likely you have to upgrade the RAM in pairs, whereas many other logic boards, you only have to upgrade the RAM one stick at a time. So do realize that there is this difference between single-channel and dual-channel motherboards, where sometimes you do have to upgrade the RAM in your hard or in your computer at pairs at a time. They have to be the same type on both channels. Otherwise, your computer will not be very happy at you, or very happy, yeah, with you. Oof. Okay. So how about this big ugly thing? What do you think this might be? So this is more of at an angle, whereas before we've seen all of these motherboards at a sort of a top-down view. What do you think this crazy-looking device might be? Well, that's very specific, but yes, you're right. It is the Northbridge heatsink. But more generally, this is a heatsink, and its sole purpose in life is to take the heat that these CPUs generate, and these CPUs generate lots and lots and lots of heat, and tries to distribute them evenly among this very large metallic object, where the idea is that now, rather than all of the heat being on this very small CPU, there's now a lot of metal that is exposed to the air, where a fan, or even if it's just sitting there, the heat will be able to radiate away from the CPU. And so the modern machines have many, many of these. In fact, normally, or what you would see a few years ago would just be a heat sink or two on your CPU and not really on anything else. But as computers, that is, the performance becomes higher and higher and faster, even these less important chips, such as this Northbridge chip, which we may or may not talk about, it's really not that important, also increases in performance and therefore also has a lot of heat coming off of it. And so this is just a way to distribute heat away from the chip, which is underneath here. You can see it at sort of a 45-degree angle and move heat into the air rather than it just being sitting on the chip itself. Let's see. So, oh, yes, one thing that I forgot to go over on the other logic board is that pretty much every motherboard or logic board in existence has one of these things on it, a battery. It's just a watch battery, and you can see it on the logic board that's being passed around, and if you were to open up your computer, you would see it on yours as well. Why would a computer need a battery? It's especially if it's not a laptop. Right, so more, yeah, so BIOS, but what else? What's really important? Yes. Right, so it keeps the time. So if you ever wonder how your computer is able to keep the time when you turn it off or when you unplug it, it is with this watch battery. And in fact, that's really how it works. It's just sort of a watch internally that uses the battery to keep the time. So if your computer starts to lose a lot of time or if it doesn't keep the time at all, what do you think you should first suspect? Yeah, the battery, exactly. So if you ever turn on your computer and it says, oh, I forgot the time, you have to reset the time, usually, if it's not some silly software thing, usually the first thing to take a look at is the battery. So if you take nothing else away from this, now you can go home and say, your friends will say, oh, man, my computer's not remembering the time. You say, ah, I know how to fix that. Oh, yes, so here are a variety of other ports as well. So this... this is on that same Dell logic board, and this has some ports that we didn't discuss before. What is this really bright, disgustingly bright purple thing right here, violet, pink? Yeah, printer. So it's, well, I mean, you can see the big printer icon right there, so that's cheating a little bit, but this was before the days of USB. Printers would connect to a computer using this parallel connection. So if you see this very fat, it looks sort of like a VGA connector, right? It looks sort of the same, it's just wider. This is a parallel connection. It's an older connection used for printers. And if your computer has it, you may never use it, and you shouldn't feel sad if a new computer that you buy doesn't have it. I personally haven't used one of these probably since, I don't know, high school. It's been a long time. So anyway.
I used one last week.
You used one last week?
In my old printer in my office is parallel.
How old is your stuff?
How old am I?
That's a good question. So here's another port, a serial port. So I actually would make a joke about how old this one is too, but I actually had to use it recently as well. And this, if you ever have looked around on your computer and you came across this program in Windows called Hyperterminal, and you click on it and it shows you this big scary window of... baud and bitrate and parity and all of these stupid little details. Usually it's talking about communicating with another computer over this serial port. And most likely you may not ever actually use a serial port at all, but it is just another connection that you can use to connect two computers together. So what I really wanted to get into just briefly, just as a teaser as well for next week, is just how some of this stuff ties together. And so we talked about how the CPU does the processing of all of this information and how the RAM temporarily stores this information, but the storage is actually just a hard drive. And so there's these various levels of storage inside of a computer. Basically, the closer you get to the CPU on a diagram such as this, the faster the memory becomes. And in fact, the CPU itself has some memory on it, and it's very, very little, but it does have some memory on it so that it can very quickly access bits of information to process. And so as you move away from the CPU, you can store more and more things. So in general, you buy a hard drive that has a lot more storage than RAM, for example, but on the CPU, you have some storage, but it is much less than the RAM as well. So as you go to the right on this diagram, you're able to store more and more and more things. But also, as you move to the right, accessing the data on that storage gets slower and slower and slower. So you can think of it as it is more bloated, you have a harder time accessing this information. Any questions on this sort of stuff? Okay, so what about these connections that are between the CPU and the RAM and the storage? Well, I showed you on the logic board how there are the traces that actually connect things between the different connectors, but generally these are called buses. Generally there's a bus between a CPU and a RAM, and it's really just, you can think of it like a literal bus whose sole purpose in life is to transfer things or information from one place to another, and that's really all it is on the computer as well. There is a bus that transfers information from the CPU to the RAM, vice versa, from the RAM to the hard drive, and vice versa. So with that said...
Is that an accurate depiction of a bus?
This is highly accurate. This took me a long time to find on Microsoft's WordArt site. So certainly, this is a very, very good thing. But one of the things that, where is it? Just like this is an accurate depiction of a hard drive. But with that said, the buses, so one of the things that do control the buses is that Northbridge chip that we were talking about before, if we wanted to tie that in to that previous image that was there. But with all of that said, it's just sort of a teaser for next week where we start to take apart more of these things into greater and greater detail, like how does a hard drive work or how does some of this stuff get shuffled between these various connections. So unless there are any questions, thank you all for coming, and we will see you next week.